I remember a weekend ago, during our day long, on practicing with thoughts and emotions, Lucy asked a question about fear and particularly having had a lot of impact from the events of the last month or so. And we explored that in the context of that day long, in the context of looking into how we practice skillfully with thoughts and emotions, particularly difficult ones. And then the day after, I wanted to do something that continued that kind of inquiry, and we focused a week ago on a number of ways. I think I had 10 ways of working with reactivity as a theme of how to be skillful when we are triggered or reactive, and I was using reactivity very much as a translation of dukkha, usually translated as suffering. And I've been reflecting in some other settings on this theme of fear. And I thought that it would be useful to explore in a little more depth the nature of fear, both in the context of how we work with it when it's there in our own experience, and how we relate to others when they are fearful, and how we understand these larger social situations. I think I'll be doing so partly through some questions that I ask you, and partly through telling a number of stories. So, a number of stories tonight that will help us to look at this challenging phenomenon. So I thought first I'll read one of my favorite, from one of my favorite books, which I don't know if I read it from a week ago, The Book of Qualities by Ruth Gendler. Ruth is a neighbor of mine in Berkeley and a friend and a poet, and she's taught poetry in the schools. And this was a book she wrote quite a long time ago, but she's quite well known for it. The Book of Qualities is a compilation of her own personifications of maybe 50 different states of mind and states of heart. So if I look at the index, there are one-page characterizations with her own drawings of doubt, faith, compassion, guilt, power, perfection, suffering, excitement, innocence, fear, patience, loneliness, complacency, anger, boredom, shock, honesty, harmony, blame, truth, service, alienation. So the reading on fear. It's interesting also to see, you know, with these 50 different states of mind and heart, she personifies each of them as either a man or a woman. I think when she wrote this, there wasn't as much awareness about transgender. I'm sure if she did it now, there'd be at least one or two transgender roles or someone who is some quality, which is a he at the beginning of the paragraph and a she at the end of the paragraph, much like I think you know, and we have a lot of transgender bodhisattvas. You know, what is it? In India, the bodhisattva, or the being dedicated to a certain quality, dedicated to compassion, is male. And then at the, as that Avalokiteshvara goes to Tibet, becomes Tara, who is a female, but also is male. And then in China, the transgender shift is complete. And what started out as a male bodhisattva of compassion, by the time it comes to China, is Kuan Yin, who's female. So, fear. Fear has a large shadow, but he himself is quite small. He has a vivid imagination. He composes horror music in the middle of night. He's not very social, and he keeps to himself at political meetings. His past is a mystery. He warns us not to talk to each other about him, adding that there is nowhere any of us could go where he wouldn't hear us. We were quiet. When we began to talk to each other, he changed. His manner started to seem pompous, and his snarling voice sounded rehearsed. Does that resonate with any voices of fear in the public? The snarling seems rehearsed. I won't name names. Okay. Two dragons guard Fear's mansion. One is ceramic and Chinese. The other is real. If you make it past the dragons and speak to him close up, it is amazing to see how fragile Fear is. He will try to tell you stories. Be aware that he is a master of disguises and illusions. He almost convinced me that he was a puppet maker and I was a marionette. Speak out boldly, look him in the eye, startle him, don't give up. Win his respect and he will never bother you with unimportant matters. So I want to explore particularly what we find when we look carefully at fear. And then secondly, how we practice skillfully with fear, whether it's personal or interpersonal, or looking at the social realm. And then we'll open things up and explore. So in a way, the two themes I'm looking at, the question of what is fear and then how do we practice whether they're related, because we really learn about fear by being mindful of fear, by looking carefully at it, by seeing its nature. And I was thinking, it was a prominent theme in my first part of practice, that I can remember several times when fear was arising and I had a chance to look at it carefully. I remember one time when I was in my later 20s, and I was doing walking meditation during a retreat. And I found myself really afraid of a woman who was doing walking meditation next to me. I said, "What is that about? Right? What am I afraid of?" I mean, I wasn't afraid that something was going to happen, that this person was going to stop the walking meditation and bop me on the head or something. I wasn't scared of something physical, but something. And I remember I just stopped there and I said, "Why am I afraid?" And really wanted to look into it. And so that kind of inquiry, really the looking, is a big part of what we do with fear or anxiety. Part of what we find is that there's really a range of experiences that we could bring under the rubric of fear. You know, like many of these challenging thoughts and emotions, it's not one thing. You know, and so there's this whole range, and so we can see, when is there anxiety? You know, and what does that look like? What does that feel like? What's it like in the body or the mind or the emotional energy? And then it can be stronger. There can be stronger anxiety or quite strong fear. And fear can even be something which in certain situations just comes automatically to us, even if it's not so much suitable. And there can be fear because of trauma, personal trauma or social trauma. There can be fear that's right there. So it's helpful to know these different situations. But what we want to do is kind of say, what's it feel like? What's it like in the body? And particularly, what's it like in the mind? What's going on? So if you had to reflect, maybe think of a situation where you felt fear. Maybe on a scale of 10, maybe think of 5 or 6 or 7, not the worst. But kind of, it could be a fear or a significant anxiety, just to reflect right now about that situation. And ask, what were some of the manifestations in my body? And what were some of the manifestations in my mind, in my thoughts? And what would you say? Let's go back to how it is in the body. How does fear manifest in the body? It could be quite different. And why don't you give me your response, and I'll repeat things where everyone can hear. So, the heart pounding, right? Heart pounding can be one. What else? Yeah.
Real tightness from the throat to like past the heart space.
Yeah, tightness and. In the throat, the heart, could be tightness in the belly, could be a lot of sense of constriction, mm-hmm. tightness, yeah.
Hyperventilation.
Hyperventilation. Could be hyperventilation. Could be, you know, some of what happens with fear is that there's adrenaline goes in the body, that we're activated as if to meet a threat. Yeah. One of the things that we'll find is that, you know, fear is something that, of course, is in all creatures, and it's there for certain reasons. You know, it's there to tell us there's a threat, and to summon our energy so we can respond to the threat. And those are actually intelligent aspects of fear. Sometimes we can hear the idea that fear is simply a problem, get rid of it. But I think I'm going to suggest that fear is both intelligent at times and very delusional at times. And our work is to discriminate and really see what's going on. Not so easy all the time. Because fear, like in that story by Ruth Gendler, sometimes has us like a marionette held by a puppeteer. What else in the body? Yeah.
I had an experience once many years ago, and I would... And I came out of the experience fine, I mean, in terms of my physical safety. But for years after that, every time I would relive that experience, and I suffered from mild PTSD, I was told.
Well, yeah, what were the actual physical experiences? That's what I was asking for.
The physical experiences were, first of all, adrenaline.
Adrenaline,
Get out of there. You're going to be fine. Just move.
Okay. Well, let's... I'm going to come to the mind in a moment. I'm trying to isolate the physical and the mental. Just the mental right
later,
now.
I would get panicked.
Yeah.
And I would tremble a little.
Trembling, yeah.
Or I would get short of breath.
Yeah.
Or I would get tight.
Yeah.
My hand, you know, I'd do this with my hands. I'd grip.
Right, tightness, constriction, yeah, adrenaline. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe one or two more. Yeah.
Your colon can.
What?
You can have to move your bowels, or.
Right. There can be kind of an agitation that causes one to defecate or whatever. That's very common. Yeah. And please, yeah.
Feel paralyzed sometimes.
Paralyzed. Very common with fear. Yeah, I mean the. Typically with fear, like it can lead to fighting or fleeing or freezing. And the freeze is one major way of reacting to fear. Yeah.
I have the opposite where I can't sit still.
Yeah, so movement. Again, you can understand in terms of that fight, flight, or freeze. Yeah. Just two more.
I get sweaty palms.
Sweaty palms, so yeah.
Nausea,
very much, yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Tingling sensation in the whole body.
Tingling, yeah. And I'll do one more. Okay.
Sometimes there'll be a lack of peripheral vision.
Yeah.
And difficulty hearing.
Difficulty hearing, yeah. So a lot of these things happening, and it's very good to know that. Very good to, I think it's very helpful to study that fear. Again, I had one retreat where... Again, it was round around that same time where I was becoming self-conscious of, kind of complex, and I was becoming self-conscious of swallowing. And I had the idea that I was, that good meditators didn't swallow as much as what I was doing. So I was getting into my, you know, personal image, right? And yet I was swallowing a lot, and I was getting really, I couldn't control it. And it was like my whole sense of self started to get deconstructed and fall apart. It was really scary. And I sat with it, and this went on like for a week, you know, quite a number of hours a day. And I got to watch the fear, and part of me knew that this was ridiculous, right? And there's some sense of knowing, but I got to watch that fear develop and study it. And it was very helpful. And part of what we do with our practice, particularly, is we study, you know, study a lot of things, but one of the things we study are difficult emotions that we really get to know so that when they come, we're familiar with them. This is one of the great benefits of our practice. And particularly if you do retreats, retreats are wonderful and weird enough so that all sorts of things happen. You know, may those in the Marin Sangha who are now on retreat be having suitable, wonderful, and weird experiences so they come back with many wonderful stories to tell and are a little bit more awake. Yay. So what happens with the thinking, with fear?
Racing thoughts.
What? Yeah.
Racing thoughts,
yeah. Very quick thoughts, a lot of repetition with the thinking. Yeah, you can also look outwardly to public, you know, public reactions to scary things, yeah.
Catastrophizing.
There's a big part of fear is catastrophizing, the way the thinking works. Forming catastrophic scenarios and believing them, right? Mm-hmm. This is what we would call the non-skillful ways that fears can manifest. Again, I think it's helpful to say, you know, some people use the language of saying there are skillful aspects of fear and there are unskillful aspects. Some things that are happening with fear are intelligent. You know, they're drawing our attention to something that's good to draw attention to and to respond to, right? And I think that this is very important because when we see fear in the public realm or people even manipulating fear, seemingly, I think it's very important to have some empathy for the fact that there actually are real fears, even if they're being manipulated, and that we can have some empathy and understanding for those people rather than just be self-righteously criticizing them. We can have that sense. But then we can also see the catastrophizing or the way that the thought becomes delusional. That's very important to see. Please, Mary, what else happens with the thinking?
I have found through practice that if the fear is only like a 6 or 7, that I automatically start doing meta.
Yeah.
I find my breath because I feel my breath getting weird.
Yeah.
And my body now automatically goes to the meta, which is really good. When it's been much higher level of fear, I'm fine in the moment, and then afterwards, I can't even talk. My mind is just so overwhelmed that I just can't even speak.
So there can be, with some fear, there can be a sense of overwhelm. Again, we can have paralysis of thought just as much as paralysis of body. Lucia, what else happens with the thinking?
Obsessive thinking.
Catastrophic thinking,
Just the opposite of catastrophizing, which is dismissiveness.
Dismissiveness of the fear.
If you're a catastrophizer and you get together with a dismissive person, doesn't balance out.
So probably some of you are therapists and do couples counseling with two members of a couple who are facing the same significant fear, and one catastrophizes and one dismisses, and you have some work to do. So maybe one or two others about the thinking. Maybe someone who hasn't spoken yet. Yeah, please.
Black and white.
Yeah, black and white. Often there's a need to have clear meaning when one's fearful. And so there may be black and white. It could be, the black and white could take the form of blaming or judging, right? I'm scared, therefore this person's to blame. We see that in scapegoating in the public realm, right? People become fearful. Scapegoating, very, very common, and we know that historically, right? We see that historically. Basically, after every traumatic experience in our country, there is a fearful reaction, which typically gets into the unskillful or delusional types of thinking. You know, example would be after Pearl Harbor, the rounding up of Japanese Americans, a lot of fear, a lot of sense of, oh, we have to do something similar to right now. And yet later, you know, I think you know, around 1980, there was a congressional commission which studied the internment of Japanese Americans, and this was the Congress, and they reported very clearly, they said there were no valid national security interests in locking them up, and that it was that what happened was based on, this is a quote, race prejudice, war hysteria, and the failures of political leadership. And all of those are present now, right? So very helpful to know, study in oneself, how is it like, what's it like in the body? And again, we can have some empathy for people who have a lot of fear, and for ourselves. I think I'm going to come back to that, and maybe go to metta, as Mary did. And so how to work with fear, how to practice with it. I think for oneself, if there is fear, metta, some heart practice, compassion for oneself and others, very beautiful, very helpful. Generally, much like I was saying last time, when we are out of balance, could be with fear, could be with something else in our practice, we want to come back to balance. And metta can do that, as well as a number of other things. Talking with a friend, sometimes being with beauty. I've heard some teachers say that being with the beauty of nature is one of the primary antidotes to fear, or being with the beauty of art when one's afraid, when there's a lot of anxiety in the system. So we want to find a way to come back to relative balance. Then if we can, it's really valuable to go right into the fear, to really deliberately choose to go into the fear. I talked with a friend a few days ago who told me that when she had cancer, and she's well now, but she wasn't sure what would happen. She was 40 or so, and she had two kids and a husband, and she said, I don't know why, but I wanted to go deliberately into the fears that I had of leaving my children, leaving my husband, leaving my meaningful work. And I went right into it and really could feel those fears, and it helped me not be fearful. It helped me to be present with them and feel more joy, just the joy of the moment, you know. And sometimes we can really choose deliberately to go into the fear. You know, when we're on retreats, that this is something we can do. We can choose, like I chose and received support, to be with the fear that I was experiencing and to study it. And it was, I think it's important, like last time we looked, I think it was an addition to my talk, that we want to know on a scale of 10 what level the fear is. And certain tools are suitable for 5 or 6 or 7, like studying it, going into it, that are not so, you can't do them when they're 9s or 10s. Really important to know that, really important. Or to, you know, it's like you should have this little checklist. Okay, what's happening? What's it like in the body? What's going on in the mind? What level is it? And out of that, there'd be different responses, right? Mm-hmm. If it's a 9 or a 10, and how do we come back if we're feeling overwhelmed, you know? And again, we would want to go to something that brings us back to balance as well as possible. And it's going to be individual what we do. But I'd read from one of my favorite texts. This is from the 11th century. This is from Milarepa. And this shows a few ways Working with fear. Okay, so people know who Milarepa is? Milarepa, one of my heroes from the 11th century. I have a kind of a Tibetan woodblock print of Milarepa from in my living room.
How do you spell it?
Milarepa. This actually means, I think, cotton cloth. So Milarepa is one of the great and beloved practitioners in Tibetan culture. He lived in about the 11th century. He was one of the early practitioners. His teachers were Tibetan. His main teacher was Marpa, who had gone to India and brought back some of the teachings of the time. Some of the yogic practices that work with the body in a deep transformational way. And then some of the meditative practices of the time. And Milarepa had been a serial murderer in a way. I don't know if that's quite fair. He had, and there's a movie that you could probably see on Netflix about his life, which I think was done by a Tibetan director. And he's wondering, he became the most beloved practitioner in the history of the country. He sang songs. He wrote poems, and I'll read a little bit of that. And he, people sing them in Tibetan culture. And so his story is, he was just, I think, a boy working on a farm, and his uncle did something very, very mean that caused his family to lose a lot of their money, and did some things that put his family in jeopardy. And Milarepa wanted to get revenge, and so he studied so-called black magic. And he particularly learned how to cause horrible storms, hailstorms. And at one point, he caused a hailstorm to occur that came down and killed his uncle, also killed a number of other of his relatives. And he went on with that, and at a certain point, he was feeling like something was off in his life. And he heard about the possibility of studying meditation and studying the path of wisdom and compassion and peace. And he went off and studied with Marpa. Marpa was called Marpa the Translator, had recently come back again from India with these teachings and was translating them into Tibetan. And Marpa met him and saw that, you know, in Buddhist language, we would say he had a bit of karma to deal with, you know, because he had. And so he was asking, please give me the meditation practice. Please give me these practices. I want to practice. I want to transform. And he thought that there was a little bit of what we would call character work to do first. And so he had him build stone towers. And he would have him build a tower, and then he would say, "It's not quite right, let's take it down." And I think he did this 11 times. Milarepa was getting frustrated, but he was also developing patience. And according to the stories, his karma was being worked through by this. But he was getting frustrated, and Marpa's wife said, "Please, please give this one the teachings." And at a certain point he said, "Okay, we'll give you the teachings." And he gave him the teachings and he went off and he lived as a hermit in the mountains. And because of his yogic practices, he was a master at the practices of inner heat called tummo, and could actually only wear a cotton cloth and survive in a cave in the cold winters of Tibet. I've done these tummo practices. They can really generate inner heat. It hasn't been my specialty because I've got central heating in my house. But it's intriguing. Anyway, Milarepa developed this, became a great practitioner, was living, and went through all sorts of transformations. And this is a story. Here's a story now from that gives you a little background. This is a story about Milarepa facing fear. Okay? That's why I'm telling you this story. Milarepa's mind became blissful, and he carried some wood back up to the cave. When he arrived there, he found in the cave 7 metal demons with bodies the size of thumbs and eyes the size of cups. Some were making fire, some were bringing water, some were grinding flour, and some sat performing various magical tricks. So there were 7 demons. As soon as Milarepa saw them, he became frightened. Okay, so he's going to now go through, depending on the degree of difficulty, a series of practices to work with fear. He meditated first on his deity. So he did a kind of practice that brought him in connection with something that gave him strength. He uttered a subjugating mantra. So it could be similar, again, this is that culture, that language. It could be something, these were his balancing techniques. This was what he did to sort of work through the fear. Uttered a subjugating mantra, performed a gaze, and aroused the deity's presence. So he had the sense of something very powerful that he could rely on, something like metta, right? He then meditated on compassion and friendliness, but was still unable to pacify them. He thought, these might be the local deities of the place. Although I have been here for months and years, I have not praised them or given them any bread. So he sang a song of praise to the place. So he tried his usual practices. They don't work. And so he says, let me have empathy towards these demons. And he sings... He sings this song, but he wants to get rid of them. Okay? He still wants to get rid of the fear. He's not just going into it. Later he'll use that practice. Right now he still wants to get rid of them, but he says, if I use compassion, I'll get rid of them. He sings a long song, and at the end of the song says, you non-human demons assembled here are obstacles to my practice. Drink this drink of friendliness and compassion and be gone. Thus he sang, 3 demons who were performing magic went away, but he still was unable to make the other 4 go away. Higher degree of difficulty. Okay, so he does something that helps them go away. Realizing that they were magical obstacles, he sang another song of confidence in the Dharma. Okay? And then he concludes, it is wonderful that you demons came today. You must come again tomorrow. From time to time we should converse. So he's saying that it's okay for them to be there. He's not trying to get rid of them. He's saying, come again. You know, it's sort of a quality of investigation. Then 3 of the 4 demons vanished like a rainbow. The remaining demon performed an imposing dance. And Milarepa thought, this demon is very vicious and very powerful. So he's assessing the degree of difficulty. Okay, in my language, okay? So he sang another song. A demon like you does not intimidate me. If a demon like you could intimidate me, the arising of the mind of compassion would be of little meaning. Demon, if you were to stay here longer, that would be fine with me. If you have friends, bring them along. We will talk out our differences. Ah, I feel compassion for the spirit. With friendliness then and compassion, and without concern for his body, Milarepa placed himself in the mouth of the demon. So this is further practice. This is like just letting the fear be there. He placed his head in the mouth of the demon, but the demon could not eat him and so vanished like a rainbow. So sometimes it works like that. Sometimes when we're willing actually to be with the fear, we find out that what we were mostly afraid of was our fear. Like in Roosevelt's statement, the only thing you have to be afraid of is fear itself. I had one experience like this where I was at a retreat and I had decided to spend all of my time in solitude in my cottage. And particularly not eat meals with the other retreatants. When I did that, something aroused fear in me. I actually didn't have any thoughts. There was just fear that was in my body. Nausea, tension, constriction. Really a tremendous heaviness of my body. I didn't have thoughts. But it was just like that. I knew it was fear, and I knew it. I had sort of tripped some internal wire where my mind was saying, this is too much solitude. This is scary, right? And I kind of, a little bit like what I just read from Milarepa, I then had a teacher come and said, what would help you to move out of your fear? And we went down a few lists, and I said, more joy would help. And so I spent some time looking at spider webs, looking at nature. I also went back and ate with the group, so I had less solitude, and the fear went away. Then 3 or 4 days later, another teacher came, and I was really proud of defeated fear, but of course I hadn't, right? I had done Milarepa as one of his first two little techniques. And then she said, what about the fear? And I said, I'll look at the fear. Or she said, how about looking at the fear? And I said, okay. Not really wanting to. And I said, okay, I'll look at the fear. And I thought that, you know, going back with more solitude would kind of get me right back in the fear. So I said, I'll do it, but I'm going to do it. This was in the morning. I'm not going to do it at lunch. I'm going to do it in the evening meal. I'm going to wait a while. Kind of these things for me are funny. Kind of like, oh yeah, I'm going to do it, but not yet. Right. So I went, you know, then I gave myself pep talks, read my spiritual books, did all these things. Okay, when that nausea comes, I'm really going to be with it. I'm going to really use my mindfulness, really notice it. And then I go back, you know, and dinner time comes, I bring my meal, I'm by myself, more solitude. And I sat, waited for things to happen, and nothing happened. Nothing happened that evening. Nothing happened for the next 2 months. I was on a long retreat. There wasn't any fear there anymore. It was like the fact of being willing to look at the fear went through most of the fear, apparently. It's interesting, right? So maybe we've all found that sometimes when we actually go directly into the fear sometimes and are willing to face it, sometimes the fear isn't even there, particularly if it's an older one, right? The willingness to be with it. It's one of the mysteries and interesting aspects of fear. When we sometimes look at it, it goes away, yeah, with some kinds of fears, particularly more psychological ones. How to work with fear with others. You know, here I'm going to just finish with a few stories. How to work with fear with others. And this could be also something applicable to our larger situation. I heard a story just at lunch today from my brother-in-law, named Ron Smith, who's for a lot of years worked with the homeless, with Catholic, is it St. Vincent de Paul? Is that it? Yeah. It's St. Vincent de Paul in Berkeley. He's worked with the homeless a lot. And he was telling the story that he had heard of a priest who was on BART one day. This was after, I don't know if it was, I think it was probably after San Bernardino. He was on this BART train, and at a certain stop, the police came in, and the FBI came in, and they told everyone to stay in their seats. And they didn't say what was going on, but it was FBI was there, and they, you know, everyone kind of looked around. And they were scared. Everyone was silent, kind of paralyzed. And there was a younger man there who looked Arab. And everyone started staring at him. He looked like he was from the Middle East. And he had a beard, I think. And people were nervous and they weren't sure who this was. I think people were going towards that as a possible object of fear. And at that point, a woman who was sitting next to him spoke up quite loudly and said, oh, where are you from? And he started answering, said, you know, I'm from Turkmenistan, and I'm a sailor, and I'm here visiting some friends. And they carried on this conversation, and everything just softened. There's this one person's kind of just maybe kindness and some bravery Because I imagine everyone was focusing there. And after they started talking about it, it was really clear that this person was not a threat. Right? But I think people before that, people's minds were going there. So it's that kind of act of kindness. And that's one of the ways we respond to fear, you know, when it's in the interpersonal realm. I think I'll read another story. I'm getting towards the end, but this is such a powerful story, and some of you probably know this one. This is from Terry Dobson. And this is a story about Terry Dobson is an American who was a student of Aikido and studied Aikido for 10 years in Japan. Aikido is a martial art that's really understood as a nonviolent martial art that is dedicated to establishing peace. So this is his story. The train clanked and rattled through the suburbs of Tokyo on a drowsy spring afternoon. And you'll find the story, I think, is very similar to the story I told about the BART train. It's about a way of responding to fear. Our car was comparatively empty, a few housewives with their kids in tow, some old folks going shopping. I gazed absently at the drab houses and dusty hedgerows. At one station, the doors opened, and suddenly the afternoon quiet was shattered by a man bellowing violent, incomprehensible curses. The man staggered into our car. He wore laborer's clothing, and he was big, drunk, and dirty. Screaming, he swung at a woman holding a baby. The blow sent her spinning into the laps of an elderly couple. It was a miracle that the baby was unharmed. Terrified, the couple jumped up and scrambled towards the other end of the car. The laborer aimed a kick at the retreating back of the old woman, but missed as she scuttled to safety. This so enraged the drunk that he grabbed the metal pole in the center of the car and tried to wrench it out of the stanchion. I could see that one of his hands was cut and bleeding. The train lurched ahead, the passengers frozen with fear. I stood up. I was young then, some 20 years ago, and in pretty good shape. I'd been putting in a solid 8 hours of Aikido training nearly every day for the first 3 years. I liked to throw and grapple. I thought I was tough. The trouble was my martial skill was untested in actual combat. As students of Aikido, we were not allowed to fight. Aikido, my teacher had said again and again, is the art of reconciliation. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you are already defeated. We study how to resolve conflict, not how to start it. I listened to his words. I tried hard. I even went so far as to cross the street to avoid the chimpira, the pinball punks who lounged around the train stations. My forbearance exalted me. I felt both tough and holy. In my heart, however, I wanted an absolutely legitimate opportunity where I might save the innocent by destroying the guilty. This is it, I said to myself as I got to my feet. People are in danger. If I don't do something fast, somebody will probably get hurt. Seeing me stand up, the drunk recognized the chance to focus his rage. Aha, he roared, a foreigner. You need a lesson in Japanese manners. I held on lightly to the commuter strap overhead and gave him a slow look of disgust and dismissal. I planned to take this turkey apart, but he had to make the first move. I wanted him mad, so I pursed my lips and blew him an insolent kiss. All right, he hollered, you're going to get a lesson. He gathered himself for a rush at me. A fraction of a second before he could move, someone shouted, hey! It was ear-splitting. I remember the strayly joyous lilting quality of it, so maybe it's like, hey, more like that. As though you and a friend had been searching diligently for something, and he had suddenly stumbled upon it. Hey! I wheeled to my left. The drunk spun to his right. We both stared down at a little old Japanese man. He must have been well into his 70s, this tiny gentleman, sitting there immaculate in his kimono. He took no no notice of me, but beamed delightedly at the laborer, as though he had a most important, most welcome secret to share. "Come here," the old man said in an easy vernacular, beckoning to the drunk. "Come here and talk with me." He waved his hand lightly. The big man followed as if on a string. He planted his feet belligerently in front of the old gentleman and roared above the clacking wheels, "Why the hell should I talk with you?" The drunk now had his back to me. If his elbow moved so much as a millimeter, I'd drop him in his socks. The old man continued to beam at the laborer. "What you been drinking?" he asked, his eyes sparkling with interest. "I've been drinking sake," the laborer bellowed, "and it's none of your business." Flecks of spittle spattered the old man. "Oh, that's wonderful," the old man said, "absolutely wonderful. You see, I love sake too. Every night, me and my wife, she's 76, you know, we warm up a little bottle of sake and take it into the garden and sit on an old wooden bench. We watch the sun go down, and we look to see how our persimmon tree is doing. My great-grandfather planted that tree, and we worry about whether it will recover from those ice storms we had last winter. Our tree has done better than I expected, although especially when you consider the poor quality of the soil, it is gratifying to watch when we take our sake and go out to enjoy the evening, even when it rains." He looked up at the laborer, eyes twinkling. As he struggled to follow the old man's conversation, the drunk's face began to soften. His fist slowly unclenched. "Yeah, I love persimmons too," his voice trailed off. "Yes," said the old man, smiling, "and I'm sure you have a wonderful wife." "No," replied the laborer, "my wife died." Very gently, swaying with the motion of the train, the big man began to sob. "I don't got no wife. I don't got no home. I don't got no job. I'm so ashamed of myself." Tears rolled down his cheeks. A spasm of despair rippled through his body. Now it was my turn. Standing there in my well-scrubbed youthful innocence, my make this world safer, democracy, righteousness, I suddenly felt dirtier than he was. Then the train arrived at my stop. As the doors opened, I heard the old man cluck sympathetically. "My, my," he said, "that is a difficult predicament indeed. Sit down here and tell me about it." I turned my head for one last look. The laborer was sprawled on the seat, his head in the man's lap. The old man was softly stroking the filthy matted hair. As the train pulled away, I sat down on a bench. What I had wanted to do with muscle had been accomplished with kind words. I had just seen Aikido tried in combat, and the essence of it was love. I would have to practice the art with an entirely different spirit. It would be a long time before I could speak about the resolution of conflict. Thank you.
Medic for Ishai, who is in the hospital recovering from another stroke, and for Donna, struggling to assist her mother in Santa Barbara, who broke her hip.
That's it? Yeah. So we have a few minutes before we finish at 8, if there are any reflections or questions. So I love those. I love the story that I heard about the BART train locally, and interestingly also in a train in Tokyo, because those were, there are many ways to respond to fear, but interesting, those were through kindness and love in that kind of situation. And again, there are a lot of complexities. Please, yeah.
I was just hoping you would tell quickly the story of how Metta came about, because that's a story about fear, and I think that's one of the reasons why I started practicing Metta, because I was going
Yeah, so it's a request to tell a little bit of about the story of the origins of metta. And probably many of you know this, but there's a kind of a legend of how metta was founded, metta or loving kindness, as an actual practice that a group of practitioners went away to a forest to practice. They were students of the Buddha, of the historical Buddha, and they went to this forest. And they were welcomed there for a short time by the spirits of the forest, particularly the tree spirits. But those, the practitioners, monastics, stayed for a long time, and according to the tree spirits, they had outworn their welcome, and they wanted them to leave. They said, this is our forest, we don't want these people here. And so they had the power to manifest really scary shapes and really bad smells, which they did, and they essentially, make a long story short, the monastics went running back in fear to the Buddha. They were scared, and the Buddha said, I have a practice for you. And he gave them the loving kindness practice, which they practiced in a situation of fear. And the bad sights and horrible visions and the bad smells came again. But they had a way to stay centered and to not be afraid. And eventually the tree spirits said, hey, these seem like pretty cool people. We'll become their guardians. And they all lived happily ever after. But it was interesting that these are the heart practices as a way to maintain balance when there's fear. You know, and I've done that a number of times personally. And other people, you know, I have many stories I could tell about using loving kindness as an antidote to fear. Okay, and one tool among several. Yeah, thank you. Interesting. I mean, there's some analogs between that story about the Japanese train and, you know, and the spirit of not trying to dominate but resolving conflict through reconciliation, right? Rather than through force. Interesting. Very relevant to a lot of things in our time. You can connect the dots if you wish. Any other reflections or thoughts or questions? Yeah, Mary.
I was just going to say that when I'm feeling fear, the nervous system, I mean the physical manifestations of fear, they make the situation worse rather than better. What I have found is just by doing my breath practice, feeling the ground underneath my feet, and then if needed to do the metta, it's like my whole nervous system just kind of calms down. It's just
And then
I'm able to make at least. I mean, and somebody mentioned how everything closes in.
Yeah.
It's true. And then all of a sudden, it's kind of like, it's really weird because when I do that, it's almost like this, like a bubble pops.
Yeah.
And I can actually see what's actually happening. And when because there's things to really be afraid of, perhaps.
Yeah.
And at least make a good choice.
That there's a lot there in what you said, you know, that I, like probably some of you, have studied trauma quite extensively, and the people I studied with didn't define trauma in terms of horrible events happening, you know, whatever, abuse or automobile accident or something like that. They define it in terms of the nervous system getting dysregulated, you know, the nervous system being out of whack in reaction to something, which I think, you know, is so. You know, someone could go into that dysregulated state for something that someone else wouldn't. So it's sort of not related so much to what happened, but more the way one is. And a lot of the ways to work with that dysregulation of the nervous system are, first of all, to not get caught in one's own stuff. So to come outward, you know, to come out, be with something outward So in that state, it's not sometimes not wouldn't be so good to meditate. It'd be good to bring your attention outward, look at something, be with something especially pleasant and beautiful, and let the cycles work. It could be to do something like Qigong or something that really regulates the body more. But that's interesting, yeah. And then to find a way to come back to balance. And then in that, with that balance, then we can actually look with more skill at what a potential danger actually is. And again, the danger could be physical, could be emotional, could be something with my career, relationship, whatever. Could be all sorts of things. But we want to look at that, but we somehow want to look at it with clarity and wisdom and empathy and not with what I was calling the unskillful aspects of fear that can take us away. Yeah, maybe last one and then we'll finish. Yeah.
I just wanted to thank you for the day long and for 2 weeks of wonderful teaching and for being part of our sangha. I just wanted to express gratitude.
Thank you. It's very easy to respond to. Thank you. So, let's finish with, and I can hang around a little bit if someone has something else you wanted to share, but I want to finish in time. I know that some of you actually have supper after this, right? We'll finish with two things. One is to see if there's something that comes out of this evening in terms of an intention or something that you learned or something that you feel called to from this evening, maybe related to the theme of our evening, maybe something totally different, maybe something else just came into perspective. So any intention coming out of the evening? And then we close with the spirit of metta. Feel maybe some, your own kindness in your heart, your own wish for well-being, for others, for yourself. And let that kindness radiate out from your heart in some way, filling up the room here. Moving out from your heart in front and back, left and right, above and below. The energy of kindness, of wishing well, of wanting to help. Let this energy meet everyone in this hall with kindness, as much as that's there. And then move outward into the world in these six directions, left and right, above and below, front and back. Out from one's good heart. And then coming back to the room, being present, keeping the attention again in the heart. And we offer the benefits of our evening of our practice, first to ourselves, to each other here in the hall, and then out beyond the boundaries of this hall to all beings. So thank you very kindly, and pleasure to have been with you these 2 weeks.